Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Hank Weaver in Hollywood, welcoming you to another session of Hollywood Byline, Coast to Coast, and inviting you to listen in on an actual press conference with an outstanding motion picture personality.
Tonight, another great name in show business. Currently the producer of Oh, You Beautiful Doll and Dancing in the Dark, Mr. Show Business himself, Georgie Jessel.
He will be interviewed by reporters whose beat is the film capital of the world. Reporters who know Hollywood inside out. Let's meet them now as we take a turn around our Hollywood press table and pick up their bylines.
Dar Smith, the Los Angeles Daily News.
Virginia McPherson, United Press.
Bob Thomas, Associated Press.
Lloyd Sloan, Hollywood Citizen News and Movie Life Magazine.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Honorary Committee, ladies of the Let's Help the Poor Sardines of Newark Association, fellow members of... This is not the B'nai B'rith. What organization is this?
Hold it, Mr. Jessel. As you'll note, there's no cold chicken a la king in front of you. This isn't a banquet. This is Hollywood Byline, a press conference.
Says, I thought I heard a gavel somewhere.
No, Georgie, this isn't a dinner table. It's a press table. And we don't want you to give a speech.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All these reporters around the table want to do is ask you some questions, and when they're through, they'll be glad to answer any questions you want to ask. That's all there is to it.
Well, it sounds okay, and I think that Mrs. Truman and Zanuck would approve. Shall we proceed?
We shall, and start off with Lloyd Sloan.
Since we started out on this business of being a Toastmaster, Georgie, President Truman calls you the Toastmaster General of the United States, doesn't he?
Well, this is highly complimentary, but the President didn't make this up.
Who made it up?
This was made up by a fellow member of your Fourth Estate, Mr. Earl Wilson. Earl gave me that title, and then the President used it after that.
I see. Well, Earl Wilson then calls you the Toastmaster General of the United States. But how
you can tell anybody else it was the President, but I'm telling you, fellas, it was Wilson.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. How many jobs of Toastmastering do you do a year?
Well, I would say that I make about 200 speeches a year.
Is that day and night? I mean, well, lunches and dinners
included? Whenever I'm called upon, and it's rather easier for me because I don't eat any of the food at any dinner. Well, this is saying nothing against any of the catering, but I eat at home because, as a rule, somebody nervous sitting next to you puts cigar ashes in the stuff and another fella spills it. And I'd rather eat at home.
Well, I was going to ask if you don't get tired of eating chicken a la king, but don't you ever get tired of looking at it?
Well, I don't look at it. If I go to any dinner where that's the best thing to look at, I send Cantor to a fair like that.
Well, Georgie, when you go to these many banquets, doesn't it take an awful lot of formal clothes, dinner jackets? I think you told me once you had about, five or six or seven or eight brand-new $200 dinner jackets.
Well, I told you that, but not the price. I have exactly seven dinner jackets, four dress suits, and three Sunday suits. But they average about $60 a piece. And that's only now.
Do you get them wholesale, sort of a cut-rate price?
I get most of my clothes from a place in New York called Roger Kent at a very small price. Firstly, because I am a 38 short, and that comes right out of the window. I need no alteration. I don't look like Monchu, but at least nobody says, let's hit him when I go out.
Well, Georgie, what about that monocle? That's pretty swanky looking.
Well, it isn't. Well, I wear a monocle not because of swank, Virginia. I have sometimes a little watering of the right eye. And during a broadcast or sometimes a stage appearance with a spotlight, it'll bother me in reading, or it'll bother me anyway. Now, I wear the monocle because if I took out glasses, it's no good if you're telling a joke. It is much better audience psychology to say, well, isn't he eccentric? Then isn't it a shame he can't see anymore?
Dar Smith.
George, incidentally, do you prefer to be called George or Georgie?
I like Georgie now.
Why is that?
Because it takes off a few years. Children say, if they call me Willie, he must be also a very young person.
Well, George, you mentioned B'nai B'rith and that Sardine Association from New Jersey. It was in Newark, yes. You will go to many more organizations of that type. Do all jokes go before all organizations, or do you have to have a new formula, a new routine for each organization?
Well, I don't know whether I'd have time to do all of this, but I can tell you very accurately and very honestly. Every good joke has a place. Now, the question is to find the right flowering to the joke and the right word picture around it. For example, I addressed a group of students at the Harvard School of Journalism. Now, this is rather tough for me because I've only had 8 months' education in my life when I was 8.5 years of age. If I keep talking, this will matter for myself. But I told them they could ask me questions after my lecture was over. But I warned them that I knew very little about any higher mathematics or any algebra, So if they ask me, for example, what is the population of Patagonia, this will remind me of my Uncle Morris, who had a store there, and that joke fits. So it's just a question of finding the right framework for a joke, and if it's a good joke, you can tell it anyway.
You're going to have a lot of uncles, too.
Yeah, well, you can make a joke about Jolson's age, and if you're politically now, you make it with Barclay, and romantic jokes. You wait and see what's happened during the day.
Do you ever get a little confused and tell a B'nai B'rith story at a Democratic rally?
Well, that would be all right. But what I do is, and this is on the record, I come to every dinner fully prepared, every word, and particularly a good opening, if possible, if I'm lucky, and a good closing.
Does that mean you actually rehearse it, or it's just...
I have everything on paper in front of me.
All the ad-libs and everything.
Well, so something may happen, somebody falls down... You say you've been drinking Snyder's ketchup or something, but as everything, and particularly if it has to do with anything that's important, and particularly with a reputation to uphold.
One thing I want to know, have you ever been speechless?
Oh, I was speechless at one occasion, and this was my dearest friend, Eddie Cantor. We were at a dinner at a banker's convention. We were both speaking, and I suddenly remembered that most of the things I had on paper, I had said to these same bankers 2 years before. And I had forgotten about it. So I said to Cantor, I think I'll open with these two new gags. And I told them to him. He said, they're very good. And he got right up and told them.
Best friend, huh?
I know you've talked before every president since... how far back shall I go?
Well, Bradford, I made a speech as a very... No, as a very young man, at a thing that the dinner that Mr. Wilson gave. And I spoke to Mr. Cooley, not long... And his answer was even shorter. And most of my speeches have been made in the administrations of Mr. Roosevelt and Mr. Truman.
I think we can all say that.
Yes.
Well, Georgie, I think we've had enough speech making. I want to get a little bit of about your personal life into this. Now, haven't you had... How many wives is it?
I've been married only three times.
Oh, I'm sorry. I gave you an extra one.
Well, I tell you why that happened. I married the same girl twice. And no religion could be against that. I mean, we just realized we'd made a mistake, and we were remarried. And later, she realized she'd made a mistake the second time.
Well, didn't you give all the ups and downs of your married life, give all the details of that in your book?
All the details that were printable.
Well, is it true that you have pictures of all your wives lined up on your desk?
I have three pictures of my three wives on my desk, because I have a lovely desk and a lovely office, and my wives were lovely.
As you've been noted for your good taste, I hear your daughter's kind of cute, too.
She's awful cute. She looks like her mother, and I hope she don't go out of it.
How old is she, George?
Eight.
Tell me, does it gripe you to have columnists and comedians kid you about your marriages, particularly
It does now, because I kind of feel that's jokes that are in the same key as the Mae West jokes and the exploits of Harry Thor and Will Dempsey beat Frippo. I think that's surely yesterday's news, because I haven't been married in many, many years.
Well, the same thing goes in for all the gags about Jessel couldn't come because he couldn't get a babysitter for his wife.
Yeah, that's a little dated, don't you think?
I think so. Yeah. Especially with the second generation.
That's right, because they don't know about that. They think I'm a nice, dignified producer who makes warm, nostalgic moving pictures.
Lloyd Sloan?
Well, Georgie, you've had a lot of experience with marriage, obviously, from these questions. Do you have any advice for people about a happy marriage?
Well, there isn't any advice that anybody can be given on anything that's purely emotional. And there are every possible theory has been offered by everybody. And the only thing that I would say is just this. People to be happily married have to be awful stuck on each other. Whether they have books in common, political interests in common, or whatever else they have in common, that's just second or third. In order to be happily married, you got to be awful stuck on each other. Then you forgive the other things that happen.
George, what's the actual story behind your start in show business? Weren't you with Cantor and Wenzel and Jolson? Didn't you all get together originally?
Well, I'm sure that Mr. Jolson would be very happy to hear that. When Cantor and Winchell and I were with Gus Edwards, Jolson had already been with Christopher Columbus. No kidding. No, Mr. Jolson isn't as old as people make him out to be, and I hope I'm as virile when I reach his age.
Georgie, how old are you?
I'm exactly 51. But Al was a big star when we first started. And Well, we all looked. As a matter of fact, both Cantor and I did imitations of Jolson in those days, and still doing it in a measure.
What was your first job together with Cantor? What did you first do?
Cantor sang, and I sang in a motion picture theater in New York, in Harlem, on 116th Street. Winchell and I were partners. I was 9, and Walter was about a year and 2 months older than I am. So 9, 10, and Eddie was about 16 or 17. And my mother was the cashier. She sold the tickets in the theater. Winchell and I got $4 a week, and he thought I was overpaid.
How did you happen to get together with him?
That was put together by the manager of the theater. My mother brought me and said, Georgie can sing. And he said, well, there's another kid around here, and another guy had another kid. By the way, we were 3 of us. We called ourselves Leonard, Lawrence, and McKinley. The other guy, Jack Weiner, he's an agent here, he was Leonard, Stanley Lawrence was Walter Winchell, and I was George McKinley.
Georgie, how does it feel to be tops in show business still, after all these years?
I've been awful lucky the last few years. And particularly experience in these few tough years of show business has come into play and has been more important than it ever was in the past. The guys without the background are going to have a tough time staying up there from here in.
Lloyd Sloan.
Georgie, Professor Labermacher was, as far as I can remember, your most famous act. How did that originate?
Well, the last time I played Labermacher was in a show called Showtime. That began through a mistake. I was rehearsing in a musical show in 1930, Billy Rose's show, in which I played with Fanny Brice and Jim Barton. And Billy Rose didn't have the great showman experience that he has now. And we were to open on a Tuesday night, and we were still rehearsing on Saturday. Scenery didn't fit, the thing, nothing worked well. And, well, the girls were so tired, we rehearsed at 5, and I found an old trunk with costumes on and kept putting on several makeups to amuse the chorus girls, particularly in people who weren't in the scenes. And I finally came to this character of this poor old Czechoslovakian professor, and I did some of it. And Billy said, that's good enough to put in the show, and that was its birth.
How about doing a few lines from the act?
Well, he comes out, as you know, he can't walk and he can't see, and he sputters and he says, oh, the ladies and gentlemen, I've let's introduce myself. I am Professor Labermacher, which came here from Czechoslovakia to make here a few lectures, and then he falls down. Poor guy.
Well, Georgie, what does Labermacher mean?
Nothing. Just the name, like you say, Silbermacher. Anything. It sounds like a Middle European name.
Well, Georgie, I always thought your mother on the telephone was your most famous act. How about doing a few lines from that?
Well, that's true. That was the thing that whatever endearment I might have in the public heart and mind was talking to my mother honestly over the telephone, in which I used to say, hello, Mom, this is Georgie. Remember? Georgie, your son from the money every week. But I don't do that anymore now because, first of all, people looking at me say, gosh, your mother must be awful old, you know, and shouldn't make jokes. Since she left the scene, if I'm playing anywhere and anybody says, talk to your mother, I have this rather sentimental but very honest answer that I don't do that anymore because, unfortunately, there are no telephones where she is.
What about the old vaudeville days, George? Do you think vaudeville is coming back, or do you think that Milton Berle is going to kill it before it starts breathing again?
Well, I don't think that vaudeville will come back because the vaudeville theaters are not constituted to have a variety show. The new generation of both theatergoers and the people that are in the business have been taught to talk into a microphone. And vaudeville meant a full variety. You can't play dramatic sketches running up and talking to this thing. So I don't think there'll ever be any renaissance of vaudeville. The television, as it stands now, can use up all the acts that are around because the people know that they were surefire, you know? But I don't think that there's any chance of it staying back permanently. Not at all.
Darsmith?
Do you think it's possible, then, for the kids of today to get the same kind of training that you got with Winchell and Jolson and Cantor with Gus Edwards?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's impossible for any of the new generation to get that kind of training because most of the stock companies are gone. But the only one thing that takes its place is that kids today are so much smarter than the kids of yesterday that they might not need that much schooling in minor leagues.
Well, Georgie, you and Jolson and Cantor went on to be pretty famous guys in the theater and movies. What happened to Winchell along the line? How come he went into the newspaper business?
Well, he was very, very young at the time that he started into the newspaper business, and I think he had a great flair for that, and he's very fortunate that he did, because very few actors can ever become as important to the nation, if at all, as important a man as Winchell has become to the world in general.
Well, does he do a lot of favors for his old pals, or do you have to have a good news break to get on just like anybody else?
Winchell is a newspaper man, and Winchell sticks to the newspaper business, and if it's a good break, he takes it, and I don't think he's affected with any great sentimentality, which is, as a newspaper man, a good newspaper man should be.
Do you think if he had stayed in show business that he would have been a star on the par with you and Jolie and Cannon?
It's quite possible. However, the gods of Thespis will have to figure that out. And let me know later what that means.
How'd you happen to make the decision, George, to leave the entertainment field or the actual getting up on the stage part of it and get an end of the production end of the movie business?
This was not my idea at all. I'm happy to say it was the idea of a man who came to see me three times in a play and then said, this is Joe Skank, and said, Mrs. Zanuck is getting out of the service of the Army very shortly, and I want to talk to him about having you play and write a picture about vaudeville as soon as you get through. And Zanuck came to see me, and we spent some time together. We'd known each other in the past. As a matter of fact, Mr. Zanuck is responsible in a great measure for a great many successes that people don't know about. And he came to me and said, Georgie, I think it's about time you had the dignity of a desk behind you, and I'll give you a 2-year contract. See what happens. If you make mistakes, you can get out the Laubermacher suit and the telephone and do your act. If not, that was 7.5 years ago.
And you're still there?
Still there, and I got a little bit more to go.
George, didn't you produce some shows on Broadway, though, before that?
Yes, all failures. All failures.
Well, Zanuck didn't have much to go by then, as far as the production is.
Well, because the moving picture and the theater are not relative in any sense of the word. This question hasn't been asked me, but I must say, they don't fit at all. They make no sense. I can name you three great stage directors who now have great successes that don't know anything about directing a moving picture, and I produced a couple of musical comedies that failed, and I've made, say modestly, 6 big musical pictures that have found favor with the audience and have made money.
Mm-hmm. Well, Georgie, I'd like to get a little personal again.
You would,
Yes, that's me. Speaking of romances and things, you cut quite a swath along Sunset yourself. I think you maybe 51, but you get in the wolf's hair like a mixmaster does. Well, what's with you? Have you got a steady girl, or are you going to get married again?
Well, no, I haven't got a steady girl. I go out a great deal with a girl called Abigail Adams, who I think is very pretty, and I think I have a date about 2 weeks from now for dinner with Miss Joan Crawford. And last week in New York, I had a date with Faye Emerson, and I just have dates. And I'm at a stage in my life where, I've said this before, but not on the radio, I love lightly in self-defense.
Back to you, Lloyd Sloan.
Speaking of your recent New York trip, George, I understand you did 44 personal appearances in 3 days. How do you manage to do all of this?
Well, as so many people have said, and Mrs. Eddy particularly, and a lot of people have said, it's what your mind tells you to do, and I think if after the third performance I wasn't getting over, I might have quit and got very tired. But audiences that get you for nothing are always very nice to you. So they applauded, and I had it very easy. I had an Ash car with the twin bed thing, you know, which you could relax in very nicely. And I had some coffee, and an uncle of mine sent me some schnapps. That's a Romanian tea, you know.
Uncle in Patagonia?
Same uncle in Patagonia, yes. And I just made it. I'm a little tired now, but it was a good thing.
Do you intend to keep up this hectic activity?
No, I think it'd be impossible to do that. But I believe that everything heroic should be done for anything that's done theatrically now, because it's become a pretty close business, and a lot of people are staying home playing canasta, and a lot of people stay home for other reasons. And I think that everything should be done, unless you've got a big smash, for example, like Pinky, then that's a big hit by itself. But when you have a picture that needs help, you should give it every heroic treatment. And I'm going to suggest, fellow motion picture, it'll kill me for this, I think when they finish a picture that they owe to themselves, their own popularity as well as their company, not to take a vacation in Palm Springs, but to go around the country and make appearances with the picture so that the people will come closer to them, like they are to the guy in the television over the radio who seems to be talking right to them in their own home.
Virginia, you wanted to get in there?
Yeah, I was wondering if what Georgie's trying to say is that he thinks stars should get down off their little ivory tower or their little mink-lined peak and mingle with the people.
I think so. I think they should not so much mingle with the people, but I think they should get closer to their audiences.
Bob Thomas.
What about doing a Jessel story in pictures? Why should you be different? Everybody else is.
Well, remember, everybody has tried. The great thing about the Jolson story, and has made it such a great success, is that behind the Jolson story, you had 28 great phonograph records that Al was doing.
Yeah.
So your script could run about a minute and a half, you know. Not that the stories weren't good, because they were, but it had that. There is a story, strangely enough, that is being written called the Jessel story by Norman Krasner. And maybe someday, it better be quick, don't you think? Unless they say he started in a wheeling chair and wound up that way.
I hear they're talking about a remake of The Jazz Singer. Didn't you originate that role on the stage?
Yes, I did.
Was the story behind why you didn't do the picture?
Well, the best, the sound story about it, outside of any personal things that happened, is as follows. They wanted to do it in a way that I insisted was wrong. The play had a very unhappy ending on the stage. It was a tragedy of a boy giving up his career and doing everything in his life, as a matter of fact. And I had been in the theater all my life, and I felt that that's the way it should have been done. And if I had it to do over again, I would have agreed that they were right to do it with the happy ending and not the futility that it had as a play. And also, they were very fortunate in getting a much greater artist than I, Jolson.
Well, Georgie, even though you've left the theater, you apparently still have a deep regard and love for it, because most of the musical pictures that you've made have been backstage pictures. How about doing something different in a musical?
Well, I've just finished one. I'm glad you brought it up, because I haven't plugged anything in my picture. Well, I've just made a picture called Dancing in the Dark, which is backstage of the movies. And the first picture, with the exception of A Star Is Born, that has shown anything about the movies behind the scenes where they're not a lot of schlemiels. I'll explain that to Miss McPherson. The Schlemiel is a kind of a dope.
I know a lot of them.
And this is kind of honest. And it's real backstage, and it's an honest story that shows that an industry that has made so many people happy and at the right price throughout the years can't be just a lot of dopes. They must be pretty smart. And the principal part is played by William Powell, who gives the greatest performance of his entire career. And he's not as old as Jolson, and he wasn't with Gus Edwards, so that's the end of that.
Well, and that's the end of the first part of our press conference, Mr. Jessel. We'll return to you, and you can ask a few questions of our panel. We'll be back to you in a few moments while you make some notes, but now let's give some attention to Richard Tufeld.
Let's indulge in a few fanciful dreams for just a minute. Let's suppose it's 10 years from now. You're the star of this particular dream, and you're traveling around the world. It's a pretty wonderful idea, but it doesn't have to be only a daydream. If you've always wanted to travel abroad in later years, you can make that happen. And you can start in making it a reality now by putting all your surplus cash in United States savings bonds. Savings bonds are convenient to buy through the payroll savings plan or through the bond a month plan at your bank. So play it smart. Invest your extra cash in United States savings bonds. And now, back to Hollywood Byline and your moderator, Hank Weaver.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to your reserved seat at our coast-to-coast Hollywood press table with our guests for tonight, Georgie Jessel, and our panel of reporters. Virginia McPherson of United Press, Dar Smith of the Los Angeles Daily News, Bob Thomas of Associated Press, and Lloyd Sloan of the Hollywood Citizen News and Movie Life magazine. They have just had George Jessel on the answers spot in our Hollywood press conference of the air. And now it's time for him to ask them a few questions. So if you're ready, go ahead, Georgie.
Well, all right, Hank. I think that you people who have a very good inside out here should realize and should tell your many newspapers, particularly your critics, that a moving picture made in America can't be the same kind of a picture that's made in England. For the first reason is that we have a tremendous audience of youngsters in this country. And for this reason, they're the kind of kids that go to the picture at 9:30 in the morning. While they're smarter than any other child in the world, they still can't have things painted on the screen from as quite as adult as the English and the European pictures are. And yet when we make a picture, some guy takes it apart in some town and says, oh, this is not nearly as this hasn't the suavity of an old coward thing, and he's looking at an Abbott and Costello comedy.
Well, I think you have a good axe to grind there. I think that critics should realize that certain pictures are for certain audiences, and that the producers don't make a Abbott and Costello picture to show at Harvard and Yale.
That's exactly right.
For the kids.
Well, I wish you'd both
want fun.
Both use your influence with that.
I just wondered, Georgie, about the British, don't they? Don't the kids go to the movies over there?
Evidently they don't. Most of their picture theaters, particularly in the United Kingdom, open around 6 o'clock at night. And I think, I'm pretty sure, that outside of a few, they get much more money, you know, admission price, than we do. Much more. I know there are $3 and stuff to get in at night, so they can afford to have 1,000-seat theaters, you know, and play to a very literate audience. Whereas we have to depend on the popcorn to pay the rent.
And another thing, they make pictures especially to be shown to children.
Well, that I didn't know. Do they?
Yes, do.
We can't differentiate. Because what are we going to do with the poor mother in America who hurries those dishes to take little Morris or little Mike to the picture theater? You going to put him under the seat?
Do you have another question, Georgie?
Well, I was going to say this. I think that we suffer a great deal from an over-strict censorship in American moving pictures. And I think you suffer for it on the radio, too. Now, the theater is having a very banner year. Because the theater is... Now, I don't say that people should do anything vulgar or anything in that line. But still, they must remember that the American family has grown up. And I think that Aubrey Child understands that people kiss longer than they do in Grimm's fairy tales, and that it's perfectly all right to have a room with a bed in it, because there are beds in rooms, and an awful lot of things that they make us cut out that shouldn't be cut out.
Is this for me, George?
Well, it's pretty good for you, because your column is here, and I think that... Without throwing any approaches, I think you've got a lot of weight around here, and I know your newspaper has. So I'd hit it, write a couple of columns saying, now looky, all the people that censor us go to New York and see South Pacific 10 times. And look what happens in the first 15 minutes of that show, and if we make the picture, we can't use a line or a suggestion of it.
Well, let me put it this way. I think that the press is very much in favor of the argument you've been giving, and from what I've been able to gather, I have a lot of very good friends who are screenwriters, and I know... One of them right now is having a devil of a time trying to get a script approved by the Breen office. Their argument is that the Producers Association is responsible for these rules that are in effect, and you, Georgie, are a producer.
The Producers Association, which is governed only by the heads of the companies, you know, not us, not the just by the heads of the... They are called the Producers Association. But they are handicapped because there is a threat above their heads at all times. As if we don't give it this rating, we have 3,000 theaters that won't book it no matter what it is.
Well, then what it boils down to is it's the pressure groups around the country that really are the basis of the problem.
I would definitely say that.
Well, Georgie, there's one thing I always wondered. I've seen a lot of movies that had risque lines and double entendre in them, and yet a gal can't wear a sweater on the screen. Why? I think people wear sweaters in real life on a cold day.
That's one of the things. I mean, there are certain people who... refuse to realize that sweaters are worn in real life.
People wear them to keep warm, too.
That's right.
Mr. Jessel, you've given our panel considerable to think about. Perhaps you might have a closing question for them.
Why, the only closing question that I would have to you is this. I think it isn't a question. It's merely a summing up. This is the first time I've been on the show, and it's the most interesting show because the questions that have been asked me have been very literate and very good, and... I think you're going to get an awful lot of listeners, and the next time that you want me, I'll be happy to come, particularly if I have something else to talk about, for example, that my picture, Dancing in the Dark, will soon open all over America.
Thank you very much, Georgie Jessel. But before saying goodnight, a word of sincere thanks to you for appearing on this program. And may your two new pictures, Oh, You Beautiful Doll and Dancing in the Dark, set new records at the box offices around the country. Our thanks, too, to our panel of reporters, Virginia McPherson of United Press, Dar Smith of the Los Angeles Daily News, Lloyd Sloan of the Hollywood Citizen News and Movie Life magazine, and Bob Thomas of Associated Press. See you all at our Hollywood Press table at the same time next week. Until then, this is Hank Weaver saying good night from Hollywood.
Listen again next week at this same time when ABC, over many of these same stations, presents another edition of Hollywood Byline, featuring an exclusive press conference on the air with an outstanding movie star, interviewed by reporters whose beat is Hollywood, the film and glamour capital of the world. Our guest next week will be one of Hollywood's most popular actors, Humphrey Bogart. Hollywood Byline is directed by William T. Johnson and is transcribed in Hollywood. Now, a listening reminder.